I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. Election Day is this Tuesday, and besides state house, judicial, school board, and municipal government races, Pennsylvania voters have an important ballot question. They'll be asked if the state constitution should be changed so that county and local governments and school boards won't have to rely on property taxes for revenue. That's where schools get a substantial portion of their funding. The wording of the question needs some explanation, and the implications of its passage could be significant. That's why we asked Ryan Briggs to join us. He's a reporter for City and State PA. And Ryan Briggs, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me, Marty.
You're welcome. I'm going to scare a lot of people away, but I'm going to actually read this thing just so people know what we're talking about. And then, Ryan, we can deconstruct it. This is the proposed constitutional amendment. Shall the Pennsylvania Constitution be amended to permit the General Assembly to enact legislation authorizing local taxing authorities to exclude from taxation up to 100% of the assessed value of each homestead property within a local taxing jurisdiction, rather than limit the exclusion to one half of the median assessed value of all homestead property, which is the existing law. That is some convoluted language there. Can you boil that down to us so that voters know what they're asking or being asked to decide?
Sure. And I mean, as you can tell from some of the ambiguous language there, I mean, you know, there's a lot going on. There's a lot of question marks kind of included in this. So it might be best just to try to explain what the intent of the ballot question is. And this is sort of an outgrowth of a movement to abolish property taxes in Pennsylvania that's been going on for, you could say, some decades now. And the aim of this measure is essentially to create a system where school districts and counties and municipalities, any local taxing authority, would have the option to exempt homeowners from up to 100% of their property taxes. So it's sort of a sideways measure of opening up just the possibility of localities completely eliminating property taxes. Now, it doesn't mean that they would have to, but it would give them the option to do that, which they currently do not have. They can exempt up to 50% of a property's value.
And this would be 100%, assuming
it could be up to 100%, depending on, like it says in the ballot question, it's essentially giving Harrisburg the okay to pass legislation that could then exempt up to 100% of a property's value, that it would replace the property tax income with some other revenue stream, which is also unclear what that would be.
Well, let me pick up on that. So let's say this passes. Let's say that the people vote to pass this amendment to the Pennsylvania Constitution. What would happen next? And it sounds like it gets then tossed back to the General Assembly.
Yeah, that's right. It would be Harrisburg would have to then kind of create legislation that would handle this. And again, what that would look like exactly, it's very unclear based just on the language of the question itself. And a lot of that would have to be dictated by the General Assembly. And I believe that it would be possible that they would pass legislation that wouldn't even allow the full 100% exemption. That could happen. You know, what the funding source might be that Harrisburg identified to make up for any shortfalls caused by local taxing authorities taking advantage of this new system, that's unclear. Probably income, sales tax, a mixture of, or nothing could happen, potentially.
Or nothing could happen. I mean, even let's say we're maybe getting ahead of ourselves. Let's say it does pass. It goes to the General Assembly. They then make the next move, and what? We could stick with the system that we already have?
I'm not sure if the language requires Harrisburg to pass legislation, but it would create the option to pass legislation that would allow for additional property tax exemption. Again, some of the reporting that I've seen on this says that it's possible that there would be virtually no change from the current system if Harrisburg kind of waffles on what exactly to do next.
And property taxes, in many ways, largely pay for schools, right?
Yes. Most of the something like $12 billion of the state education funding comes from local property taxes. I think that's something like 41% of all of the education funding in Pennsylvania, which is higher than many other states.
Right. You said this really came from people complaining about the fact that their property taxes have gone up. You also identified a couple of counties where that seems to be a problem, not Philadelphia County or even the surrounding counties here in the southeast part of Pennsylvania. Where are people feeling this property tax pinch?
Because the Pennsylvania educational system relies more heavily on local taxation. You have very uneven levels of property tax rates from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. So some of the main sponsors behind this bill, which has notably attracted bipartisan support, there's the Democrats that have signed on to this and Republicans. Some of them come from places like Schuylkill County or Berks County, the Redding area, others from the Poconos, areas that for a variety of different reasons have seen pretty significant localized increases in property tax rates, mostly to cover school costs, rising healthcare costs, rising pension costs. In some instances, you've got building projects that are being paid down. Fixed costs that are hard to kind of get away from, and you may combine that with an aging population, an aging tax base that maybe is on a fixed income, that's chained to a property that they bought, 20 or 30 years ago when they were earning perhaps more than they're earning now. And that seems to sort of be the kind of key ingredients here for where people get really riled up. So this isn't an issue completely across the state. I mean, people in general are, taxes aren't really popular anywhere. But there's some areas where you have seen a grassroots movement to push this kind of legislation, to push property tax abolition as a movement. And those tend to be those areas, aging, and have these pretty significant fixed education costs.
You were telling me before going on the air that this was not unlike New Jersey. And we know that people living in New Jersey complain bitterly about the high cost of their property taxes. So some parts of Pennsylvania are on that same high level?
You'll hear people compare it to that. And I guess to kind of complete that analogy, it's you have New Jersey taxes, but you don't have New Jersey level services necessarily. You don't have New Jersey level incomes necessarily. So these are areas where, people are, I think, genuinely stressed, and you've seen it has played out in a way where school boards are limited in terms of how much they can raise property taxes in a given year. And what that leads to in some places are these sort of successive annual property tax increases. So people, they're not delusional when they say it seems like my taxes go up every year. In some areas, they have literally gone up every single year to the maximum amount that the school board can seek in order to try to cover these costs. And in a lot of cases, that's still failing to cover these costs. So they have to go back the next year.
You mentioned the fact that there's bipartisan support, so support from Democrats and Republicans for this proposed constitutional amendment.
I mean, one prominent Democrat that I would say is at least not opposed to some of these provisions is Governor Tom Wolf, who has said since he was elected that property tax reform was going to be, one of his main priorities. I don't think he's come out and fully endorsed, property tax abolition, but when he's been asked about it in the past, has indicated that he's open to exploring different avenues for property tax relief. It's a sensitive issue for a lot of people because there is, I think, some real stress that's there.
Absolutely. Let me read an email from Charlene. She said, what are the pros and cons for a 65-year-old retired homeowner, a school tax-paying citizen? And I think this is what you were talking about earlier, that there are people on fixed incomes and have seen their property taxes going up. But if they vote to amend the Constitution, it's not like you're not going to be paying taxes. It just has to come from another source.
Right. Like the wording of the ballot question suggests, a lot of this is contingent on identifying some alternative revenue source. So it's not as though passing an act like this is going to dramatically reduce educational costs or lead to government efficiencies elsewhere. It's most likely going to lead to a scramble if the legislature decides to pick this up to find any other sort of, you know, revenue that could make up for this. So if that's an income tax increase or a sales tax increase, you know, those are possibilities that have been included in sort of prior iterations of this kind of legislation. So a previous version of the bill that sought to just eliminate property taxes altogether would have entailed some significant increases to personal income tax and sales tax that made it unworkable in Harrisburg, which is, as people may know if they're following the budget process, is very averse to raising taxes at all.
Well, and it's interesting to think if that were to happen, of course, a great big if, then it would be non-property owning people who pay sales tax and income tax then would be shouldering the responsibility of paying for schools.
There's a dynamic amongst the advocates for this kind of legislation where they feel that they are so burdened that even if there are, you know, some kinds of inequalities that come out of this movement, like shifting this tax burden more onto renters or the poor versus homeowners who are retired and, you know, have a perhaps a lifetime of savings or not, you know, depending on the situation.
Sure.
But they say we're burdened, so we will accept that, you know, there might be some downsides to this, but, you know, the current situation is just untenable. But yes, I mean, that is fundamentally what would happen, is you would be shifting more of that tax burden onto people who don't own homes, who are paying sales tax regardless of their means to pay for it.
This is an amendment to the Pennsylvania Constitution. We've had other amendments in the past. What's been the track record for just passing amendments to the Pennsylvania Constitution?
Yeah, I believe when I looked it up, of the 15 past amendments that were put before voters over, I think, the last 20 years or so, all of them have passed. Yeah. And there is currently already the ability to exempt up to 50% of a property's value from property taxes. And that was the outgrowth of a similar movement in the 90s that was approved.
The Homestead Act.
The Homestead Act.
Of 20 years ago, actually, 1997.
Yeah. So I don't see why voters would not approve this. Maybe the confusing language would put people off, but it seems likely that it will be approved. What happens next is up to Harrisburg to a large degree.
Well, it's interesting. It's an off-year election, so turnout obviously is important. We're almost out of time here. And also that the governor and the legislature are still trying to figure out how to balance the budget. So that, I think, complicates this even further.
Yeah, I mean, I just don't know how, after this protracted budget process, that lawmakers would go back and say, we need to radically increase different categories of taxes so that we can completely eliminate property tax in Pennsylvania.
Well, stay tuned. We'll find out, I guess, Wednesday morning. Ryan Briggs, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me on.
You're welcome. He's a reporter for City and State Pennsylvania, talking about this amendment to the Pennsylvania Constitution that voters will get to vote on Tuesday. We're going to take a very short break and then shift gears and talk about conservative media. We'll be right back. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. The big news this week has been the Mueller investigation announcing the indictments of Paul Manafort and Rick Gates and George Papadopoulos' guilty plea of lying to the FBI. They had all worked with the Trump presidential campaign. Mueller is investigating whether the campaign had colluded with Russia. If you watch Fox News this week, this is what you would have heard, starting with President Trump.
Well, I think the uranium sale to Russia and the way it was done, so underhanded, with tremendous amounts of money being passed, I actually think that's Watergate modern age.
If this had happened in the 1950s, there would be people up on treason charges right now. The Rosenbergs, okay? This is equivalent to what the Rosenbergs did, and those people got the chair.
Tonight, explosive new evidence in what is becoming the biggest scandal, or at least one of them, in American history.
How is this not a scandal of a much grander magnitude? This is a huge deal that threatens our national security, but nobody seems to care because it's Obama and Clinton.
And when people think Russia, they should at least be thinking Uranium One.
Conservative media has been focused on the 2010 uranium deal and Hillary Clinton claiming the real crime is her campaign's collusion with Russia. We asked Colin Borchers to join us on Radio Times. He covers media, the conservative media, for The Washington Post, and he joins us from the studios of The Washington Post. And Colin Borchers, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Good morning.
Good morning. And to our listeners, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. What we just heard, is that a flavor of Fox News in the first couple of days of this week?
Yeah, that's a pretty representative sample of what you're hearing from Trump's allies in the media, which is to say that the real Russia story of the week actually has nothing to do with Robert Mueller's investigation, except to the extent that it means he's investigating the wrong thing. Why is he not focusing on this uranium deal from 2010? And the notion, as Sean Hannity put it, that Hillary Clinton sold out our national security.
Well, and we heard Sebastian Gorka, not known for his modesty, shall we say, talking about the Rosenbergs, making some kind of parallel to the execution of the Rosenbergs and Hillary Clinton.
Right. And of course, the Rosenbergs were convicted of taking plans for a nuclear weapon and giving them to the Russians, which was, of course, a very serious violation of national security. What we're looking at here is really not comparable. So to just review some of the basics of what we have here, the 2010 uranium deal that has many conservatives in the media so worked up was a deal that was approved by a committee of nine U.S. government agency heads. So this was a Canadian company, but a company that had uranium mining interests in the American West. And they wanted to sell a majority stake of the company to Russia's Atomic Energy Agency. And because uranium is the root material to manufacture a nuclear weapon, it is a national security concern. And that's why there was this this U.S. government panel that had to sign off on the deal, which it did unanimously. They determined that this was not a national security threat. Now, fast forward to the election year, and in 2015, the New York Times, along with basing some of its reporting off of that book, Clinton Cash, reported extensively on donations to the Clinton Foundation that happened during this same period of time. So there were folks on the Russian side who clearly were trying to curry favor with the Clintons, whether it was specific to this this one deal or perhaps just something bigger. They were donating money to the campaign, to the foundation, I should say, clearly to try to get on Clinton's good side. And so the connection that the Sean Hannitys, the Breitbarts of the world are making is that Russia essentially bought Hillary Clinton's vote. As the Secretary of State at the time, she had one of the nine votes to approve this uranium purchase, and she did vote in favor. And so the notion is that her vote was bought essentially as a bribe through these donations to her foundation.
Let me pick up on several things, and thank you for that very concise description, because it's easy to get lost in some of the details here, because I have heard people say, largely coming from conservative media, that Russia now controls 20% of America's uranium, either deposits or capacity. Can you explain that?
Right. Yeah, there is a subtle distinction there, but it is an important one because the United States does import a sizable chunk of its uranium. So the 20% figure that we hear so often refers to the uranium mining capacity within the United States, but it is not 20% of all of the uranium that the United States has. So it's just important to make that distinction, because if you just say that it's a fifth of all U.S. uranium, it sounds like a much larger share than it actually is.
But in many ways, it sounds like a trifecta even more. So you've got Bill Clinton. He apparently made a speech to a Russian bank or a bank in Moscow, getting, I think, $500,000 for that speech. You've got Hillary Clinton, Secretary of State. You've got the Russians, a Russian energy agency buying a majority stake of a Canadian company that controls some of the uranium mining in the United States. One can understand, at least on the face of it, why that might raise some questions.
Absolutely. And by the way, the questions about the appearance of a conflict of interest at the Clinton Foundation are entirely legitimate, which is why that was an issue throughout the entire campaign. It's why our newspaper spent a lot of time trying to put together an extensive list of every single donor that had given money to the Clintons through their foundation and to their campaigns over a 40-year period, some $3 billion altogether. That is worth looking at. And there's no question that when you have foreign entities giving money to your foundation, they're quite clearly trying to, as I said, curry favor with you. What that does not prove, though, however, is that that money actually bought your decisions on another matter. And so, you know, the magnitude is different, but sort of an analog right now would be the many foreign dignitaries that like to come to Washington and stay at Trump hotels. You know, that's clearly some kind of gesture to try and, you know, make a good impression, curry some favor with the president. But I don't hear folks in the conservative press suggesting that the current president's foreign policy decisions are being bought and paid for, you know, through bribery, through his hotel chain or something like that.
I mean, so, it is hard to prove oftentimes quid pro quo.
It's inherently difficult to prove a quid pro quo, but I think the reason to be skeptical of it in this case is again, the fact that Hillary Clinton's State Department had only one of the nine votes to approve this uranium deal. So it just doesn't make logical sense that if you were trying to ensure passage of this deal, you couldn't buy approval simply by donating money to Hillary Clinton. She didn't have the power on her own to approve the deal. And since all of the other agency heads voted the same way that she did, if you believe that there is a great conspiracy here, you essentially have to believe that everyone else was on the take as well, which is a much broader conspiracy than anyone has any evidence for.
And that's Colin Borchers. He writes for The Washington Post, and we are talking about some of the stories that are having some play and some impact on conservative media. And you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me get Earl from, looks like, Atlantic City to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Earl. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi there. I feel that the whole uranium one, Eurasia purchase, is kind of a red herring. To me, we understand that from all the reporting that I've been reading, that they wouldn't have been able to sell uranium to Russia anyway. That would have never been allowed. So I don't understand why they wanted to buy the company in the first place. So like I said, it's kind of a red herring. But the fact that Russian-connected businessmen and oligarchs contributed so much money to the Clinton Foundation is troubling. I feel that, you know, again, you're talking about a quid pro quo. We don't know what the payoff is or what it might have been, but it's sure, you know, there's smoke. I don't know where the fire is, but there's definitely a lot of smoke there.
Well, and there are a lot of, it seems, Russian oligarchs who have been interested in the United States and the outcome of elections. Colin, do you want to weigh in on that?
Well, I would say to Earl that the uranium deal is getting additional scrutiny right now for, I think, a good reason, which is that a couple of weeks ago, The Hill published a report that at the time that the Uranium One deal was approved by the Obama administration, the FBI was in the midst of an investigation of corrupt business practices by Russia in the United States with the purpose of sort of infiltrating the nuclear industry within the U.S., and that was why they wanted to buy this Canadian company that had uranium mining interests in the United States. And that investigation concluded several years later. It ultimately led to the indictment and ultimately a conviction of one former Russian official. So the concern is, why didn't the folks who had the decision-making power over that Uranium One deal in 2010 know about the FBI's investigation that was going on at the time? Would that potentially have been useful information that might have changed the way they looked at the deal? Might they have looked at it and said, you know what, maybe signing off on this deal wasn't such a good idea? I think those are fair questions to ask, and I think that that is what the purpose of a joint investigation by two congressional subcommittees launched last week is trying to look at. You've heard Republican members of Congress say that they're looking at why there wasn't better information sharing within the U.S. government at the time. But again, what that means is that it is very unlikely that Hillary Clinton, as the head of the State Department, or anybody else who was on that nine-member committee knew what the FBI was up to. Because, again, the investigation was still ongoing. It wouldn't conclude until several years later. And so what you're seeing right now in some of the coverage on Fox News and on Breitbart and other outlets of that ilk is the suggestion that Hillary Clinton effectively ignored what the FBI was doing, as if she knew that this was a really sketchy situation, and she was willing to shove that aside and ignore it and just sort of sell out national security for donations to her foundation. But the evidence just doesn't back that up.
Let me read an email from Mike. He's raising something that I wanted to just touch on, and then I do want to talk about Fusion GPS. Mike says, please confirm that by law, the uranium mined in this country may not be taken out of the country. You want to weigh in on that, Colin?
That's true. But again, I think that the concern that folks have is that you are allowing Russia to have some control over that supply chain. And keep in mind that the alleged crimes that the FBI was investigating at the time that ultimately did lead to one conviction involved no-bid contracts to a trucking company within the United States that transported some of that uranium with kickbacks going to Russian oligarchs. So I think the concern wasn't so much about taking uranium out of the United States and shipping it off to Russia to make a nuclear weapon. It's not really so much about that. It's more about Russia exerting some influence and control over uranium within the U.S.
Well, let's talk about Fusion GPS. And there are many twists and turns to this particular story. First of all, what is Fusion GPS?
Fusion GPS is essentially an opposition research firm that was founded several years ago by three former Wall Street Journal reporters. And so there are very conflicting views of the organization in the press. You've heard folks like Brett Stevens, who is a conservative columnist for the New York Times. It was on the air on MSNBC last week saying that, you know, this is a legitimate, credible outfit. Obviously, they do opposition research. What they do is dig up dirt, but that it is run by by three former professional journalists. I should point out that Stevens is also a journal alum, so perhaps he has some special affinity for them. But so there's that view on one end, and then the other view is sort of the White House view, which is that this is a sort of sketchy organization that specializes in hatchet jobs, and you can't trust anything that comes from them. And they are significant, of course, because they are the outfit that worked with the Clinton campaign and the Democrats during the general election. They're the ones who ultimately hired Christopher Steele, the former British intelligence officer, who produced that now infamous dossier of allegations about ties between Donald Trump and Russia.
And before that, obviously working to investigate Trump for and some of the other Republican candidates, as it turns out, for the Washington Free Beacon. Is that unusual?
Well, that was kind of a twist, wasn't it?
I think so.
we had known for a while that Fusion GPS had a Republican client during the GOP primary season, and I think the conventional wisdom was that it was one of Donald Trump's opponents, that it was another politician, and as it turned out, that was not the case. It was, in fact, the Washington Free Beacon, which is a conservative website, and I would say yes, it is unusual, unless you take the view that the Free Beacon is a relatively new outlet. It was founded in 2012. And, you might say this is a case where they were wanting to do some investigative reporting. And what they essentially did was bring in some outside consultants, and the consultants in this case were three former, big league journalists from the Wall Street Journal, and that sort of bringing them in to help with some investigative reporting wouldn't be all that unusual. And I think the Free Beacon could have made that case, but they didn't. And that's sort of what's interesting about it. It was sort of this cover up, right? They didn't just come out and say that. In fact, they in some of their coverage were pretty misleading about their relationship with Fusion GPS. A story 2 days before they disclosed that they in fact were the mystery client behind Fusion Fusion GPS. You know, they had published a story that said that Fusion GPS had an unknown Republican client during the primary. Well, it wasn't unknown. It certainly wasn't unknown to you. And so, you know, that sort of the cover up in some cases was even more suspicious than the hiring in the first place.
And Colin, we have just a couple of minutes before we have to sew this up. Talking about Christopher Steele and the dossier, it seems that, at least coming from the conservative media, if we can put it that way, is that is an example of collusion because Christopher Steele talked to Russians to get information about Donald Trump. Do I have that right?
Yeah, that is the argument, and the argument is that, you know, he's a foreigner, right? He's a former British spy. So, you know, if we're so concerned about campaigns taking opposition research from people outside of the United States, you know, we should be really fired up about the DNC and the Clinton campaign working, if indirectly, with a former British spy. Perhaps there is some truth to that, but there is sort of a difference in scale here, right? I mean, there's a difference between taking opposition research from a singular British spy as opposed to what, say, Donald Trump Jr. Acknowledged in emails, which was that he wanted to take opposition research that he believed was coming directly from the Russian government, which is, you know, a hostile foreign power. I mean, so there is a difference there.
We're, again, almost out of time here. It was interesting that President Trump tweeted that Christopher Steele's company got something like $12 million. Mark Hosenball has found that he was paid $186,000. Does that matter? Is that a big deal?
Well, it matters to the extent that what the president is trying to do is to present this as like a colossal waste of money. And by the way, I can't independently verify one number or the other. But the purpose here of the president's strategy is to say there was a huge concerted effort, a politically motivated effort to take me down. This was money that was wasted because, hey, I won. And you should not, as the public, you voters should not believe anything that came out of this dossier because it was really just a well-funded hatchet job.
We could go on. Colin Borchers, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Glad to be with you.
And he writes for The Washington Post. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscoen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. The indictment of Paul Manafort earlier this week has sent shivers down K Street, home to many lobbyists, some of whom, like Manafort, have worked for foreign governments. Tony Podesta, a powerful lobbyist with ties to the Democratic Party, his brother John Podesta was Hillary Clinton's campaign manager, resigned from his company, the Podesta Group, this week. We asked Theodoric Meyer to join us. He covers lobbying for Politico. And Theo, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks so much for having me.
So what's the mood on K Street these days?
I think it is a little nervous these days. Tony Podesta was, and I guess still is, one of the most prominent and recognizable lobbyists on K Street, as well as, you mentioned, a really big donor and fundraising force in the Democratic Party.
Now, Paul, there are many things that Paul Manafort was indicted for, but one, it has to do with the Foreign Agents Registration Act, FARA. Help us understand that, Theo.
So the Foreign Agents Registration Act dates back to the years before World War II, was designed to prevent the dissemination of Nazi propaganda in the United States. It requires anyone who is working for a foreign government in the U.S. or a foreign political party to register, as well as people who are working for other foreign groups that are looking to influence U.S. foreign policy.
Now,
that is what Podesta's firm, the Podesta Group, as well as a second firm, Mercury, were doing. We're working for a foreign group called the European Center for Modern Ukraine that the special counsel, Robert Mueller, has alleged was actually sort of a front and under the control of the Ukrainian president and the Ukrainian government.
Is it unusual for a lobbyist to register under the Foreign Agents Registration Act?
No, it's not unusual at all, and many lobbyists in D.C. do foreign work. There are a wide range of sort of foreign clients that you could work for, from governments like New Zealand and Japan that are not controversial at all, or South Korea, to governments that have a slightly more controversial reputation, like, you know, say Saudi Arabia or Turkey, to little-known foreign political parties, to you know, foreign nonprofits and other groups that nobody has heard of at all.
But it does make you wonder if Manafort hadn't registered when he was actually doing this work. It seemed there are questions about Tony Podesta and others. How much? I guess enforcement teeth does Farah have? And it's under the Justice Department, as I understand it.
Yes, the Justice Department enforces Farah, and that's where you have to register. So Farah traditionally has tried to prod lobbyists who they think are not properly registered to file the correct paperwork and to register. There have been very few sort of criminal prosecutions of Farah because you have to prove not only that you know, lobbyists failed to register, but that they willfully or deliberately failed to register, and that's a pretty hard thing to prove.
But you're supposed to do it, right? I'm being a little dense here, but you're supposed to do it, whether that's willful or not.
You are supposed to do it. And for a long time on K Street, you know, there was not as much fear that if you did not do it, that, you know, maybe you would get a letter from the Justice Department and you'd have to file more paperwork. But there wasn't a fear, you know, in most cases that you were going to go to jail. One of the lobbyists that I talked with this week told me that it used to be that the Justice Department would work with you, you know, to become compliant if you were found not to have filed the correct paperwork. And now there's a fear that there's going to be more sort of criminal prosecutions.
When a lobbyist is working for a foreign government, whether it's New Zealand or the Philippines, you know, I'm thinking, or Saudi Arabia, what do they do? What is their job? And I'm assuming it's to lobby Congress or to lobby the government, what, for some kind of favorable treatment?
Yeah, that's a great question. A lot of foreign countries maintain, you know, at least one or two sort of foreign lobbyists just to have a voice in Washington. And what they do can actually vary quite a lot, from holding meetings with lawmakers to talking to lawmaker staff or administration staff, to reaching out to reporters like me. If you send an email to a reporter, you're required to disclose that if you do that on behalf of a foreign government. There are also sort of wide-ranging PR campaigns that have become more common. You see foreign governments and foreign groups running TV commercials here in Washington, running Twitter campaigns. So it's really a wide variety of activity designed to influence U.S. foreign policy in one way or another.
Do we know how many lobbyists in Washington work for foreign governments?
Yes, because they all, well, we know the ones that are
registered
with,
right,
the Justice Department, yes.
How many of them exist?
I don't know the number actually off the top of my head, but it is in the, you know, hundreds or thousands. Right. There are many of them.
And is it a lucrative practice to be a lobbyist for a foreign government? Can you make a lot of money?
It is lucrative. They are traditionally, and it varies widely from country to country, but it's traditionally seen as one of the more lucrative areas of lobbying. There's a huge number of lobbyists in D.C. who work from everything from relatively small, you know, nonprofits that pay them $10,000 a quarter to foreign governments who can pay, you know, $500,000 every quarter. So, or even $500,000 a month in some cases. So it can be very lucrative.
Who's making $500,000 a month? Do we know? Do we know?
Often it's countries that are in some hot water and have to pay a premium for their services. If you are lobbying for Japan, like, no one is going to send you angry letters, or that does not make you look bad at all. But if you're going to represent foreign leaders that may be less scrupulous, as you know, Paul Manafort did in the past, sometimes you have to pay a premium to do that.
And he represented Mobutu Sese Seko from, it was then called Zaire, Ferdinand Marcos of the Philippines, Oleg Deripaska, someone that we're learning more about these days. Is there, how much of a revolving door is there between government and lobbying firms?
There is a large revolving door, and some of the more prominent foreign lobbyists are people who are former, congressional staffers or former members themselves. I spoke to former Senate Majority Leader Trent Lott about this the other day, who has lobbied for countries including Saudi Arabia and Turkey. There are plenty of other former members who represent foreign governments. So there's a significant revolving door.
That's Theo Meyer, and he covers lobbying for Politico. We're talking about K Street, where many lobbying offices or firms are located, and the impact of the indictment of Paul Manafort on K Street. One of the things he is accused of or charged with is not registering as a foreign agent. And you can join us by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Any questions or comments to join the conversation? Let's talk a bit more about Tony Podesta. Again, he's the brother of John Podesta. As I understand it, he's pretty powerful in Washington, I think known for giving really good parties. What do we need to know about John Podesta?
About Tony Podesta, you mean?
Tony Podesta. Thank you.
So Tony Podesta has been a force in Washington for a long time. He has built up this firm, the Podesta Group, into one of the largest lobbying firms in Washington, representing a lot of very prominent clients, including, BAE Systems, a huge defense contractor, Walmart, Lockheed Martin, another huge defense contractor. He also has a reputation for dressing in a sort of flamboyant way.
I was wondering where you were going with that, Theo.
He has a home in Italy, an apartment in New York. He has an art collection that is one of the best in Washington. So he is definitely a force, and people were very, very surprised, I think, when he ultimately stepped down as a result of what is going on.
He also has worked with Paul Manafort, and maybe for those of us that don't live in Washington, D.C., that seems like an odd arrangement to have. Is that unusual?
Well, you have to understand that Manafort, until he started working for the Trump campaign, was a, known quantity in Washington who had been working in politics for decades, but was not sort of the famous figure that he is now. He spent a long time working for foreign governments and political parties overseas. So I'm not sure that it's unusual for, someone doing foreign work overseas to, help make connections for foreign governments that, want to have a voice in Washington. What is unusual is the way that, at least the special counsel alleges that this was set up, that there is a, sort of foreign nonprofit, this European Center for a Modern Ukraine, that they are alleging was really just a vehicle for the Ukrainian government and the Ukrainian president and his political party to be able to lobby in Washington.
And Tony Podesta was doing work for this European Center for a Modern Ukraine, correct?
Yes, Tony Podesta's firm was working for this nonprofit. They maintain that the nonprofit told them that it was not a sort of entity that was controlled by a foreign government or a foreign political party or something like that, meaning they did not have to register under FARA in this way. So their argument is, this nonprofit lied to us. That's why we did not register before.
How about Michael Flynn? He also had done some work for Turkey and did not register with FARA. Is he in any way implicated in all of this?
So he has not been named in any of the indictments handed down under the special counsel so far. It is widely believed that the special counsel is also investigating Flynn's activities and Flynn's own foreign lobbying. So that may be something that we will see in future indictments to come.
Are there efforts now to enforce FARA's regulations so that people like Manafort and Flynn and others do what they're supposed to do if they're going to be lobbying for foreign governments?
There are. There's been a call from senators and lawmakers in both parties who believe that FARA is has not been particularly stringently enforced. Senator John Cornyn, the number two Republican in the Senate, said at a hearing this summer that he feared these sorts of violations are happening around this town all the time, which is a pretty remarkable thing for a leading senator to say. So Senator Chuck Grassley, who is the chairman of the Judiciary Committee, which held this hearing, introduced a bill on Tuesday that would beef up enforcement of foreign lobbying rules. Along with a Republican member of the House. So Democratic senators and representatives will also introduce legislation. So we'll see if that ends up going anywhere.
An email from Warren saying, great reporting, and do the lobbyists pay their taxes? Do they pay tax? I mean, if they're paid by a foreign government, does that in any way complicate how they're going to report their income?
I don't believe so. I believe it is, reported as income the same way that you or I would report our income.
Are there ways, though, around FARA that you know of, besides not registering, but workarounds?
Yes, there is one workaround that. So if you are, you have to register either with the Justice Department under FARA or with the House and the Senate the way you would if you were lobbying for a domestic company, like Exelon or like Walmart. So if you're lobbying for a foreign government, you have to register with the Justice Department. But if you're lobbying for a sort of foreign group, it is a little bit more gray. And if you are not working to influence U.S. foreign policy on behalf of, in a way that could benefit a foreign government, you're allowed to register with the Senate or the House, which is less stringent. There's less that you have to say about what you're doing in Washington.
About a minute.
So some people go that route, and some lawmakers want to shut that off so that there's not that sort of gray area in which you can register with one or the other.
Final question. K Street used to be called Gucci Gulch. That's what I remember from a number of years ago. Is K Street the swamp?
It's a little unclear what Donald Trump is referring to when he talks about the swamp. Sometimes he seems to be using it to mean Washington lobbyists, but otherwise he at other times he uses it to attack, leading Democrats or, members of his own party or seemingly anything about Washington that he doesn't like. So I think it is the swamp when it is convenient for the president to use it that way, but at other times it can mean other things.
Well, Theo Meyer, thanks for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thanks so much for having me.
You're welcome. And he covers lobbying for Politico, the third of three guests in this hour of Radio Times. Catching up on a ballot question before Pennsylvania voters, also what's happening on Fox News this week, and talking about lobbying and the indictment of Paul Manafort. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times. You can find out much more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show. You can find us on Facebook. You can follow us on Twitter. You can also sign up for our newsletter. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Trinae Nuri. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you for joining us.